Chapter 8. Hollis. The hostess had given him a booth. He was not sure whether he should keep it or change to one of the tables that ducked decorously beneath the half wall separating the restaurant from the lobby. He decided to stay put. The tables bordering the lobby were very small, so small that the little octagonal baskets on the wall edge of each table, just large enough to hold the salt and pepper shakers, four tiny blue plastic thimbles of cream, and a glass box of sugar packets, were crowding the slender crystal bud vases, whose conspicuously assigned territory was dead center of each table. A wall table would have made for a cramped and uncomfortable meeting. The booth was bigger, quieter, so he would stay where he had been placed. Although, and this was the thing, the booths held an unidentifiable discomfort, something he could not quite place. A vague unease with their intimacy. The way they hunched over in a dark crouch like half-opened leather-lined seed pods in the back of a pantry. These were tables for secrets. The waitress, Ramada, Lydia, came by with a glass of water and a menu and asked for a drink order. "I'm waiting for someone," he said. "I'll need another menu." "Something to drink?" "Coffee, please." Ramada Lydia returned with another menu and filled his cup from a stainless steel pot, and then was gone again, over to a couple. He, in an expensive-looking suit, she in jeans and plaid flannel, feeding each other pie while holding hands. They spoke alternately in low whispers and loud bursts of illicit gaiety. Hollis checked his watch again. He supposed it was possible that she had been here on time, and, having ascertained that he was not here on time, became impatient and left. That was possible. He knew the Japanese to be a punctual culture. Extraordinarily punctual. They knew how to keep appointments. Courtesy. Honor. Respect. But 11 minutes. The Japanese were also extraordinarily patient, and bailing after 10 or 11 minutes did not fit the mold. Even 15 minutes. That was late, true. He should not have taken the bypass. He knew better with all the goddamn traffic than to take the bypass. What had he been thinking? But still, even 15 minutes is not so late. Hollis popped his head out of the booth and took another look around. 7 other tables were occupied, all but one with parties of 2 or more. He could eliminate those immediately, since he was reasonably certain she would be alone. She was on the road, and she did not know anyone in Ohio. At least he didn't think she knew anyone in Ohio, although, now that he thought about it, he really didn't know one way or the other. But even if she did, what cause would there have been to bring a friend? Nervousness? Apprehension at meeting a stranger? And meeting him at a hotel, no less? Hollis took a closer look at his fellow diners, less certain than before. No, he resolved again. She would be alone. And besides, these people were also obviously wrong. Either local business folks meeting for lunch or travelers. Standard Ramada casting. There was one woman sitting alone at a table in the middle of the restaurant reading a book. About the right age, but definitely not her. Caucasian, like the rest of them. And blonde to boot. It was not like he didn't have a pretty good idea of what she looked like. His memory was far from perfect, true enough. And Suki had been younger in the photograph, but he had the basic idea. She just wasn't here. That's all there was to it. Hollis returned to the center of the booth where he had a clear line of sight to the entrance. The vinyl leather pod groaned around him as he resettled himself. "Yes, sir?" Another waitress, Ramada Ann, appeared suddenly before him with a pitcher of water in one hand and a pot of coffee in the other. "Did you need something?" "Oh, no, thank you." "I saw you looking around, so I thought maybe..." "No, just looking for someone."
"Someone meeting you for lunch?"
"Yes, you haven't seen a young Japanese woman here, have you?"
"No, not that I recall."
"Probably don't get a lot of Japanese at the old Zumstein Drive Ramada, do you?"
"I'd remember," Ramada Ann said with a toothy smile. "And we like to call it the old I-71 Ramada. Much homier. Do you want something to eat while you wait?"
"No, I'll hold off a few minutes."
She freshened up the coffee and sauntered off, leaving Hollis to his thoughts.
Suki Takada was either quite late herself, or had already come and gone. Akihito Takada had sounded delighted to hear from Hollis, and this pleased him immensely. Akihito was not an effusive person, nor given to careless expressions of emotion or improvident gestures, but Hollis could tell that he had been pleased. And almost instantly, Hollis had regretted the trepidation that had preceded the call. It was not nervousness so much as a hesitation born of awkwardness. He really had had no reason for calling Akihito Takada. He had been thinking of him lately for reasons that were not entirely clear. Maybe there was something in the great and bittersweet summing up of retirement that had prompted the impulse. Akihito had, after all, marked a professional triumph of sorts. Or perhaps it was simply because they were so much alike. Hollis sensed they shared a natural kinship that, for reasons of distance and culture, he had neglected. Not like he had ever had much of an opportunity. It had really been just those few evenings at the house with Akihito and Izume. Not nearly enough time. That was just an icebreaker. But in the past 3 years, with no contact between them, the ice was reforming. The more he thought of Akihito, the more he longed to speak with him, just to keep the ice from thickening. But that was not something one could come out and say on the phone. And that had been the trepidation. He had played it out in his mind. The whole, "Mr. Takada, do you remember me? Hollis Johns from Ohio? I spent a lovely evening with you and your wife about 3 years ago during the Pacific Rim Conference, and I just wanted to call and see how you were doing, and wanted to say hello, and wanted to speak of our unacknowledged kinship in our unenlightened world." And could imagine only a look of pained consternation on Akihito's face. He had fumbled with a dozen business-related pretensions. Clients needing joint financing on Japanese real estate, or Ohio First Securities and Credit needing to update the officer contact list for the Hayakugo Bank, or trying to set up some sort of conference between their two banks. But none of them felt right. For one thing, Hayakugo Bank had a branch in New York, staffed with officers Hollis knew on a first-name basis. Any information Hollis really needed would have been far more easily and appropriately obtained through those channels than calling up the home office of the bank president, Akihito Takada, a man who might not even remember him. Years ago, OFSC had been a guest, not a member, of the Pacific Rim Banking Conference. There had been a few big Japanese investors looking at targets in Ohio and farther east, and that had been enough to justify sending an OFSC contingent to the conference. Perhaps, went the convenient surmise, OFSC could make some valuable foreign contacts that would stimulate investment interest. There had been a lot of board-level excitement and some infighting on the subject of just who should comprise the delegation. But in the end, the Japan trip had been a boondoggle, plain and simple. Hollis certainly had no reason to imagine that 2 years later the bank had any greater interest in Japan. Even if there was such interest, there was nothing to suggest much of a role for retirees. And now, yet another year had passed. So calling Akihito under some banking pretext did not seem promising. But more than the implausibility of the business excuse for calling, Hollis simply didn't like the idea of lying to Akihito Takada. That was not the right way to reestablish contact. He owed him the truth, or at least some culturally palatable version of the truth. Their kinship was based on common understanding, on temperament, on wisdom. Lies, even lies of convenience, were beneath them both. So Hollis had simply picked up the phone and placed the call. Nothing planned, nothing rehearsed. When Izume answered, he did not waste his time reintroducing himself to her or refreshing her memory. He simply asked for Akihito. A couple of women entered the restaurant and stopped in front of the brown, octagonal, "Please wait to be seated" sign. They were both in their early to mid-40s. A little old for either of them to be Suki Takada. Besides, neither of them was Japanese. Their faces held looks of inquiry or scrutiny, of intense searching,
which caused more uncertainty in Hollis about these women than would have otherwise been warranted. They were looking for someone. The hostess, Ramada Beverly, put an end to all further searching and uncertainty, seating the women in the middle of the restaurant between the lone reader and the illicit whispering lovers. He considered them. They were lesbians, these women. Lunching lesbians. At least, that was his best guess. Judging from the hair and the clothes, and the way they were just so out there for inspection. Not that he minded, particularly. Homosexuality was not for Hollis what it was for so many of his socially conservative colleagues at OFSC, namely a threat to the social order, a challenge to the heterohegemony that ensured everything from the sanctity of Christian values to the economic viability of an insurance-driven economy that was literally banking on the limitation of employment benefits to the other-sexed spouses. For Hollis, these arguments were all overblown and, frankly, a little on the hysterical side. If there were anything about homosexuals he resented, it was simply their strident accusations of injustice. Hollis was tired of being accused. Accused by the black and his other non-white brethren. And by the woman. And now by the homosexual. All now in a frothing, gadarene rush to affix blame for their unequal status, real or perceived. Hollis was as white and as male and as heterosexual as they came, and that gave him 3 automatic strikes in the politics of progressivism. He, because in politics there is no distinction between he and his kind, was always the enemy. Of course, the way out was always there for him if he wished. He could always prove that he was not the enemy by taking up arms against the establishment, by joining his wife, splashing around in the shallow end of the political pool, making signs and writing papers and making a lot of noise about the poor, disadvantaged homosexuals, by decrying the sins of his kind, while standing shoulder to shoulder with the dykes and the queens and those of indeterminate gender, by renouncing his social sexual brotherhood as expiation for the cultural dominance of his own biological urges. Marry or don't marry, Hollis really didn't care. Just don't make him the whipping boy and don't expect him to fight the good fight at his own expense. The women started laughing at something and one reached out to grab the other's hand in excited agreement. Dessert, Hollis suspected, would be up in somebody's room. What had happened to the proverbial closet anyway? The closet door had long since been ripped off its hinges. Again, not that he minded, particularly with the lesbians, and not even with the gay men, as long as they were polite about it. But the lesbians were somehow a little easier to take, because, as a general rule, lesbians seemed to be... 2 men entered the restaurant and, striding past the "Please Wait to Be Seated" sign, joined the 2 women at the table. Kisses were exchanged and arms were draped over the backs of chairs and menus were shared. Oh. Hollis took another sip of his coffee and looked at his watch. Still no Suki. He would give her another 10 minutes, and then it was fair to assume that they had missed each other. He wasn't going to waste his whole day. Akahito Takata would understand. After all, it was Hollis who was doing Akahito a favor. Akahito had actually laughed with delight. An actual laugh, not one of those ambiguous expulsions of air through the nostrils that, particularly from the Japanese, can mean anything from "how ironic" to "I can't believe you just said that." Akahito's reaction was a genuine, albeit rare, expression of jollity. In fact, when Akahito learned that it was Hollis Johns from Ohio calling, it was as though the call had been Akahito's idea in the first place. There was no ice to break, no awkwardness, no need for reintroduction, no need to justify the call. It was natural and right. It was almost as though they were back out in the lotus garden beneath the lanterns drinking sake. Almost. Akahito had sounded a far more effusive and enthusiastic conversationalist than Hollis had remembered. The economy of expression and quiet precision with which Akahito Takata had, 3 years earlier, plucked both thought and word from sweetly scented air, was missing. He was a torrent of words this time, sometimes hard to understand. Twice, Hollis had to ask Akahito to repeat himself. But beneath the torrent of words lay the same riverbed of wisdom, the same kinship with truth, the same unyielding allegiance with the self that the world acknowledged and accepted as Akahito Takada. It was something in the voice, the timbre or some ineffable resonance, that carried a pure and uncompromised sense of the man, a quality uncorrupted by the needs of others, the demands of others, the expectations of others. Akahito Takada still spoke the sound of freedom. A tall, thin Asian woman with silky shoulder-length black hair entered the restaurant and, table by table, began taking stock of its patrons. She was expensively dressed in slacks, patent leather boots, and a jacket of well-tailored suede. A nubby, chocolate-colored handbag kept slipping from her shoulder. Hollis half stood and waved. The woman pointed to her own chest, questioningly, and when Hollis nodded, made her way toward him in great, loping strides. Hollis could see at once that she had all the confidence and self-possession of her father. "Hello, Suki," Hollis said, extending his hand. "I'd recognize you anywhere. You're the spitting image of your father." She shook his hand and smiled quizzically. "Thanks, I think. My name is Sandra, not Suki. Are you Michael?"
"No, I'm Hollis. You're not Suki Takada?"
"No, I'm Sandra Davis."
"Oh."
Hollis slid slowly back down into the booth. "I'm sorry, I mistook you for someone else, I'm sorry. And I called you all the way over here. If I look that much like Suki's father, then my mom has got some real explaining to do." She smiled again, huge, white teeth. No laughing. "Again, I'm real sorry, I just thought." "Hey," said Sandra Davis, waving dismissively as she turned to leave. "Don't sweat it. You all look alike to us, too." Hollis watched the giant Asian woman stretch herself back across the restaurant to the sign. Ramada Ann intercepted her, pointing back over at Hollis. They both looked at him in his booth. He waved back meekly. Sandra Davis shook her head. A curly blonde stepped flexuously from nowhere, cutting off his view of the entrance. Upon refocusing his depth of field, Hollis recognized her at once as the lone reader. He glanced around her at the table she had quietly occupied since before he had arrived. Sure enough, it was empty. Book in hand, backpack over one shoulder, she stood and stared at him with cerulean eyes and fine, pale skin and naked pink lips.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I couldn't help overhearing, you're looking for Suki Takada?"
"Yes," said Hollis, still not comprehending.